Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 Degree Boiling Hot Water, straight from your kitchen tap. Not only is it a great gadget, but it's also doing its bit for the environment too. Listen to this. One of the main benefits of having a cooker tap in your kitchen is that it will save water. The tap will only deliver the exact amount of water you're using, whether it is for a large pot to boil for pasta, for the whole family, or a single cup of tea. With a kettle, on the other hand, you often end up boiling more water than is needed or decide to reboil water because it has cooled down, wasting lots of energy. What's more, the cooker combi tank delivers not only boiling water but also hot water, meaning you can have hot water straight away without letting the tap run. If you can afford one, I recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk to find out more and to look at the models. I do really love mine. On today's hour, I'm curious about what it's like to swim shark-infested oceans without a wetsuit. Today is a conversation with Adam Walker, who went from toaster salesman to swim non-stop across seven of the world's deadliest oceans, wearing only swim trunks, cap, and goggles. Not only that, he was so injured doing this, he invented a new type of swimming. No point in me telling you his story when he's on a microphone waiting to tell you himself. Let's hear from the man. Here's Adam. Hello, Adam. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I suppose we should start this. I've done the intro about how you've swum the seven seas, as it were, the seven of the world's deadliest oceans, as it says in your book. I suppose we should start by asking, what are the seven seas, so people can get their heads around it?
Yeah, so they're named as the toughest seven ocean swims in the world, or as you say, the seven deadliest, toughest, however you want to put it. So we've got English Channel, England to France, Spain to Morocco, although I went both ways, I went there and back. Molokai to Oahu in Hawaii, Catalina Channel in Los Angeles, Tsugaru Channel Japan, Cook Strait in New Zealand, and Ireland to Scotland. They're the seven.
Which is the longest in miles, I suppose, and which is the longest in time?
So Hawaii is 29 miles if you go the shortest route, but in my experience, that never happened, so it's not a good reflection. So around about 45, 46 kilometers if you go in the shortest point. And so on paper, that is the longest, but depending on what you get, tides, currents, which I'm sure we'll discuss, that can all change and make it much longer, which is what happened in Hawaii, actually.
All right, well, before we get to that story, tell us how you got involved in this in the first place then, because it's a good story.
Yeah, so I was appliance salesman, so I sold kettles and toasters. I worked for Russell Hobbs, so normal guy, normal job, looking for inspiration. I boarded an aeroplane in December 2007, going to Australia. I was bored on the aeroplane and I thought, I'll put one of those in-flight movies on. And I looked at the sports section and there was a movie called On a Clear Day. Peter Mullen stars in it. And I thought, okay, what's this about? It sounds a bit like it's not that interesting. But anyway, we'll check it out. And then as I read the spec at the top, it said, Frank, who loses his job after 35 years in the boatyard looking for inspiration, decides to swim the impossible, the English Channel. So I thought, okay, well, as a kid, I used to swim a lot. Let's check this out. And so watching the movie, obviously, he does lose his job. His mates take him on a booze cruise to France. And when he's out on the ferry, he looks out to sea and he goes, how mad would you have to be to swim this? And they're all going, totally, why would you possibly do that? And there's this bit in the movie where it goes in slow-mo and he's looking out to the ocean. And I thought, I wonder if I can do that. And I put my earpiece down to the person next to me and I said, I'm going to swim the English Channel. And they went, what are you talking about? And I just got fixed on it, really. So it started from there.
And how long was the process between doing that and actually then setting foot into an ocean to do it?
18 months of training. So I first started, I went in the pool when I got back from Australia. I was looking online how much you have to train, 5-6 days a week. You have to train like an Olympian, but obviously you're not funded. You have to fund yourself. And I just thought I'd see how capable I was. So I did 40 minutes, rolled myself on the side, coughed my guts up and thought, this is a bit embarrassing. I'm not fit enough to do this. Did it three times that week. And fast forward 5 months, I managed 5 hours in the pool nonstop. And then I booked the English Channel, having never swam outside. The problem with the English Channel is it's 15, 16 degrees water temperature, which sounds warm, but it's not. If you think a pool is 29 degrees, so if you put cold tap to the top, then that's around about 12 degrees with no warm water in your bath. So I had to get used to that and certain rules to it. So you can't wear a wetsuit, it's unassisted. So I booked, I booked it. It took me 18 months to get up to speed with the training. Lots of things happened in between, got hypothermia on one swim, five paramedics, learned a lot about myself on my journey, but got really sort of stubborn, if you want to call it that. Driven is probably a nicer word, but stubborn to master it.
Yeah, but why did you want to do it? I mean, what is the motivation behind it? What happened to you on that aeroplane that you thought, right, this is what I'm going to do, this is why I'm doing it?
When I worked for the job that I was doing, there's nothing wrong with selling appliances and being a sales guy, but I always felt different. I always felt a bit different to the others that I worked with. And I used to make fun of, you know, we're selling toasters and the world needs toast and all that sort of stuff. And I was very much joking my way through it. But I've always done sport. I've always loved sport. And that's in my DNA. But I got a lot of injuries. I played cricket for Nottinghamshire under 19s, injury, kind of running, all those sort of things. So as a kid, every time I got injured, and I was first injured at 13 with a knee problem, then 16. And I always went back into swimming as a kid, but no one cared about swimming at school. So it was like, get me up back on the rugby pitch or running or whatever. And I get injured again, back into swimming. But I never listened to the signs. And fast forward to 2007, when I'm, 27 years of age? And I got the light bulb moment and think, well, maybe the world's trying to push me into swimming. And I've got a sports science degree, but as I say, I went into the sales world. My whole family are in sales. So that was something I was used to. My father worked for Mars for 23 years, and my brother's in sales, and I have another brother in sales. So that was always there. But I just felt different. I felt it wasn't me. And I just was looking for some inspiration. And this movie gave me that inspiration.
Yeah. So why is it, let's go back to some of the points you've made already. Why is it that you don't wear a wetsuit to do these swims? What is the thought process behind that?
Well, Captain Webb in 1872, I think it was, he was the first person to swim the English Channel, and he did it without a wetsuit. And there's a nice story about him and an American chap who the first person to do the English Channel was like a race to do it. And the other guy did it in this suit, and he made this suit and he almost did it underwater, sort of snorkeled his way across to France. And Captain Webb thought he was a bit of a fraud, this guy, that he hadn't swam properly unassisted. So bearing in mind wetsuits weren't created when Captain Webb, and this guy had some sort of special suit. I wouldn't call it a wetsuit as such. He had a snorkel and he sort of floated across. So that became the way to swim the English Channel, following Captain Webb. And there was a massive gap before anyone sort of managed to get across. So the rules and regulations are you have to do it unassisted. So wearing a wetsuit obviously keeps you warm, keeps you buoyant, helps you. And in this sport, they don't want anything to help you. So you can't wear neoprene wetsuit because that's too warm. You can't wear a neoprene hat. You can't wear two hats. It has to be silicone or latex, and it has to be in a swim costume. And even if you wear shorts that are three quarters long, like in a triathlon, they ban it. There has to be normal size trunks. So they're trying to make it as natural as possible. And there's certain rules, not just about what you wear, but also you can't touch the boat. It's unassisted. You're allowed a drink, but that's thrown over the side for energy because you burn up to 1,000 calories an hour. And if you're swimming all day, you know, you're going to burn a lot of calories. So you can have that, but you're against currents and tides, so you don't want to hang around.
Right. Do you put, because we've all seen the footage of people doing the channel years ago when they used to put it on the news, do you put goose fat on yourself? Are you allowed to do that?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Yeah, that always comes out, the goose fat. Years ago, they put goose fat on them. I think maybe Vaseline wasn't invented then. And the myth, and it is a myth, that it keeps you warm. Actually, it just adds extra weight and doesn't do anything. So now they do Vaseline, which is for friction, really. So it's rubbing on your neck and the armpit. And that's what happens with salt water when you're swimming a long time. Not so much lakes or non-salt water. It doesn't seem to happen. But over hours, you get rubbing marks. So Vaseline is for rubbing. Nothing keeps you warm apart from getting faster, swimming faster, and learning to acclimatize to it.
What is the impact of salt on your body? I read about that guy who swam around Britain. His name escapes me now. But he swam around. He took him, a couple of weeks, didn't it, or something. Anyway, he swam around, but he said he lost half his tongue because the salt starts getting in your mouth and starts destroying your tongue. Is there any aspect to that happen to you?
I can't think destroy my tongue as such. I mean, probably what he's referring to, which I've had lots of, is ulcers and my, what's it called? Ulna, is it? The thing at the back of your throat, that dangly thing in Hawaii, went three times the size and stopped going down my throat and trying to choke me. And, you know, I think I've only had that once when I was younger, when I drank too much whiskey. That was the only time that happened to me. Apart from that, yeah, I've had 25. I think I counted 25 ulcers in Hawaii, and yeah, everything gets dry and you know, shriveled up. You imagine in your skin when you're in a pool for an hour, or you multiply that by 11 hours, then and you add salt water to it, then it's you can look. I mean, you know, I'm sure we'll get into the different swims, but the longest one that I've done, I looked about 30 years older when I'd finished because the swelling of the salt and, you know, what it does to the body.
Does it have any long-term impact on you?
Only a positive one with me. I mean, it created a lot in my life. So in terms of, if you're referring to a negative one, no. You know, obviously you can be stung by things, which is what happened to me, but they disappear. You know, lots of things sort of, the body, you know, the body recovers from things like jellyfish stings, from salt water, drying up your tongue and all that sort of stuff. No, you go back to normal. It tells a good story if you say, you know, you've lost this and lost that, but, you know, you should come back to normal.
How long was that longest swim then?
So in Hawaii, 17 hours I swam and it was over 60 kilometers and I finished 15 kilometers further down the coast than anyone's ever finished that swim. It was about 30-odd people now in the world done it. I did it in 2012. I also got stung by a Portuguese man-o-war, lost feeling in my spine for about an hour. What they do is they have the toxins of a cobra snake, so they shut down your organs and can kill you, put you into anaphylactic shock. Obviously, being big, that probably helps. If you're a child and you get stung by a Portuguese man-o-war, you might have a few more issues. So when I was referring to the effect afterwards, I had a nice tattoo from the Portuguese man of war for the next couple of years, and I can still see it as a nice reminder when I've got a suntan. There's lines across my stomach, but that was the most pain that I've ever had, and of course I can't get out. So it's not like a stage swim where you can get out and then start again and, you know, carry on. The rules here are you have to keep going, whether you go sideways, whether you go backwards, whether you're stung. Whatever happens, you have to keep going until you reach land.
Is there a point that you, in any of your swims, that you wanted to get out? Did you manage to make them all in the first time, by the way?
100%. I didn't want to get out. The brain's a funny thing. I trained myself to complete every single training session. So I got in winning habits. No matter what happened, you're going to Dover 4 hours, leaving at 5 a.m. when you've worked 5 days a week in Manchester, which is 100 miles one way for me, 100 miles back, managing a team, and then going to Dover and throwing yourself in the water, do 6 hours on a Saturday, 6 hours on a Sunday, and drive back and go back to Manchester. And that became my life. So when you put so much commitment into something and so much effort, then you don't want to give that up. or I certainly didn't want to give it up. The closest was probably two occasions, actually, in Hawaii when I was stung by the man of war, and then I was going sideways. Because what happened in Hawaii was I was 9 hours in, and I heard the pilot say he's going to break the world record, which was 12 hours. And as soon as he said that, I started going faster, but I went backwards for 3 hours, and then I went sideways. And then I was stung in the dark, and normally in the dark in Hawaii because the sharks, they get you out. And I knew this, but we were so close, so we stuck with it. Kayaker came in with me. Then I was stung by the man of war. Just keep going sideways in agony. And my brain overtook me and said, you're in too much pain. Get me out. And it was like I was possessed. It wasn't like a conscious thing. It was just pain. I've got to get out this pain. And then I tried to calm myself down amongst the yelling because of the pain. And the kayaker said, oh, dude, it's either a Portuguese man of war or box jellyfish. If you start to labor breathe or hallucinate, I've got to get you out. And I tried to joke, as I do, and say, well, I'm labor breathing now, but I have swam 13 and a half hours. And then I thought to myself, okay, anyone can do anything for a minute, no matter how much pain you're in. You can survival mode. So I tried to count 60 strokes for a minute to try and move forward. I couldn't even swim properly. My legs were down towards the seabed. And I was holding my stomach. So it wasn't even proper stroke. Lasted 30 seconds, stopped yelling again, started again, another 30 seconds, second attempt. And the guy's like, this is no good, looking at the boat. They sent me an antihistamine pill. I stopped to vomit for 6-7 minutes. And then I thought, make a third deal. If you can get level with the boat, that's like a checkpoint to continue. So I dragged my torso towards the boat. They leant forward on the boat thinking I'm coming out. And then I smiled at them, which was very much a grimace, not really a smile. And I managed to carry on. My whole body shaking with the shock of what's happened to me, of the stings. And then I decided in that moment, that checkpoint going past the boat, I'm not going to stop. Whatever happens, as long as the kayaker gives me hope, then I'm going to say thank you and carry on. And I asked him how long to go. And he went, oh, man, it's about an hour. And I thought, God, I've struggled to do a minute here. Done two lots of 30 seconds and 1 minute, and I'm not swimming properly. But then I then started counting 60 seconds, another 60 seconds, get to 5-10 minutes. I thought, I'll do that for an hour. I got to an hour, and I said, how long to go? And he said, 20 minutes. And then it was another 20 minutes. And 3.5 hours later of all those 20 minutes, eventually we were faced with the beach. And he said, follow me, which was sideways because it's dangerous. I said, but the beach is there. He said, follow me. I ignored him, got impaled on a rock, cut my leg open, and then dragged myself over these rocks that were just sticking up out the water, got out the water, had a TV camera in my face, Hawaiian National Press, and I thought, I better say something motivational now. And I could hardly speak because the thing was so big. It was choking me, basically, at the back of the throat. And I went, pay that for me, success lasts a lifetime. And that was somewhere on YouTube. Please don't try and find it. It's very embarrassing. But that was it. I made it. And I stood there in disbelief thinking how much I've gone through. And there was a lady on the beach who had tracked me. Who what happened really strangely was the pilot didn't want to go down the coast because he thought his boat would get beached. So all he did was he kept aiming at the shortest point because that's where he'd finished in the past. And that cost maybe another 6 hours. And she managed to convince him. She was a Hawaiian swimmer. I'll flash my lights, head for the lights, and you know where you're going. And apparently they were arguing for hours on this while I was just going backwards and nowhere. And then eventually went down the coast, finished 17 hours, probably should have finished in 11. But it was a big lesson. So that was probably the closest, but I can't, when I say closest, Tim, there was never any way I was ever going to quit. I can only tell you what my subconscious was telling me, which is you're in pain, get me out of this. But then, you know, I talk about the devil on your shoulder. The devil was huge and the angel was tiny, and the angel was talking to the devil saying, how much do you want this? How much does it mean to you? And when I flipped my mindset and thought, actually, let's look at it a different way. You've never swam more than 15 hours. Look at that as an incentive. Rather than the record, sub 12, look at the incentive of swimming longer, because what will that do you for other swims? And if you get across this, Adam, what will ever stop you again? And then I started thinking, well, what will ever stop me in my life if I do this? So it became that swim a metaphor for life for me, for confidence and belief.
Yeah, why is this though? What is it that's going on in you that you feel this need to do this? You know, you look at someone like David Goggins, who's very similar to you, I think, in that respect. You know David Goggins, the ultra marathon runner who just doesn't stop and he refuses to give up even when he's got, you know, he's done these races where he's broken legs and he's still running, or he's pissing blood and he's still going or whatever, but he refuses to give up. And you look back at his past and I've read his book, and it's like kind of quite a traumatic childhood, and you can see that he's been in a, you know, dogged place, and he wants to take control of his life constantly. Can you look back over your life and go, there's something there that made me want to motivate to do this stuff?
I do think it really helps. My dad was very much my motivator. He used to say to me all the way growing up, you know, give it your very best and don't give up. And that resonated through my head. And I was taught to give it my best to try and succeed in whatever I did. That happened in the sales world, and obviously because he was in the sales world, he taught me things about how to be a salesman and how to pass an interview and all that. And in the sport world, which I love sport, it was all about, you know, give it your very best and train hard and work hard and be disciplined. So that was always resonating in me. And when I did the swims, he was on my shoulder, really. I could see his face, although he wasn't on the boat. I could see him saying, you know, don't give up, keep going. Because a number of times, you know, even from the start in the English Channel, when I was really sick, my brain went, well, I'm so sick, how can I possibly finish this swim? Because I need calories. So all that was going through my head. I think the fact that I was getting towards the age of 30 and thinking, this is it for me. This is my career. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life unless I make a change now. And I wasn't very unhappy doing the job, but I just didn't feel I was doing myself justice. It wasn't me. I felt I was capable of something, didn't know what it was, and then watched the movie and thought, well, I'll do this and see where it takes me, taking me on this path. You know, it's funny now, you know, I'm known as Ocean Walker and people know me as that, but actually I don't necessarily see myself as a born ocean swimmer. I just decided to do it from a movie on an aeroplane, which then led me down a path. It could have been anything as long as I was driven enough to do it. So yeah, when you refer to other people thinking about this drive, and it, you know, his case was a traumatic experience and putting on weight and, you know, trying to find a way through that, I believe. So I think you need to go through some sort of, let's say, some people go through a traumatic experience, issues in some way, or they're just unhappy and they try and create something to put themselves on a different path. I think the whole thing about life is to find happiness. And some people look at me, and I've been told it many times, you're crazy and, you know, you're not normal and all that. And I say, thank you. And they go, what do you mean, thank you? It wasn't a compliment. I'll go, yeah, it was. Thank you. Because I don't want to be normal. And I think there was something about not wanting to be normal, not wanting to be part of the pack. And I've always felt that I was a bit different in some way. You know, did I think 10 years ago, or whatever it was, that I would go in this journey? What was it, 2007? Yeah, 2007. So did I think, if you said to me, look, we'll have this conversation in 2022 and I'll ask you that question and you'll have swam seven of the toughest ocean swims in the world and your life will have changed, I'd go, don't be daft. What are you talking about? But at that point, I was open for opportunity to give something a go. And then when I started going down this road, I felt like Adam. I felt like how I was supposed to be, somebody working hard towards something and, you know, overcoming discomfort. And really, these swims for me is about discovering who I was as a person. Because as a kid, I didn't want to lose. You know, 50 meters backstroke in the pool, which is what I used to do. I didn't do front crawl. I used to win without training. And I used to then do 100 meters backstroke. And the odd time I used to come second, I'd come back to my parents and say, you know, I came second, and my dad, oh, all right. And, you know, I'm almost sort of looking for them to say, well, that's all right, but, you know, my dad's DNA was okay. You know, it wasn't like, oh, why did you come second or anything like that? It was like, oh, okay. And I think it's just embedded me to try and do my best and succeed. And all those years ago, when I'm 12 years of age, doing those galas, those swim races that my mum took me to, fast forward so many years later, this represented something just bigger than that. It wasn't me versus anybody else. It was me versus me, really, and discovering who I was on that journey. And the swims are a byproduct of that. You know, at the start, I thought, wouldn't it be great? You know, I won't be remembered as the toaster salesman. I can be remembered as Adam Walker swimming the English Channel or the next one or the next one or even Ocean 7. But actually, after about three, I thought, this isn't the goal. The goal is the journey to discover Adam, to learn how capable I am and how it's rewarded me in other areas of my life, as opposed to seven swims, which, to be honest, it, you know, sounds good and it's nice to be recognized. Oh, you're the guy who did Ocean 7. But I don't see it like that. I see a much bigger picture as I've gone on. So I think I was just looking for some way of breaking out from the old Adam, which wasn't really me, and discovering who I am as a person. But I do think, like you say, Tim, and we've spoken separately and go, you know, why would you want to go into temperature and why would you want to do that? And I totally respect that not everybody will want to do these sort of things. But unless you try, how do you know how capable you are? But you've got to get to the point where you want it enough to change. It's no good saying, oh, I'd love to be that Adam Walker with who's done that and, you know, flying around the world and but you know, I just prefer to watch my TV for the next 7 days and not do anything. Please, can you let this happen for me? Well, it's not going to happen. You have to be driven. You have to go to these places, belting down with rain, my stuff getting soaking wet. I'm shivering for hours on end. And even my brain's going, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And then I talk to myself and go, well, because you've got a bigger goal here.
I wonder if you, right at the beginning of that answer, you said life, everyone's looking for happiness. And I wonder if that's true. I've thought about this a lot recently. And I wonder if people are, instead of looking for happiness, are trying to avoid misery. And that's a better goal and a better game. And I wonder if you looked at yourself as, because you mentioned it a couple of times, a toaster and a kettle salesman. I know you're not demeaning that job. However, you're demeaning it because you don't like it. You don't like that representing yourself, do you? Because you don't see yourself as that. You see yourself as something special. And I wonder if those, as something different, as someone who can achieve something. And I wonder if you're standing there on the beach in Dover going, I'm cold, I'm so... but it's this or selling toasters, and I am not going back to selling toasters, so I am taking this road. And I wonder if the motivation is rather than trying to achieve something. I know you want to achieve it because you want to be big. It's like also looking over your shoulder going, I'm not going back to selling toasters. There's not a chance. This is something that people can look at me and go, he did something with his life, rather than, I wonder if that's a motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when you open up your brain and you really analyze, why did I do this? And you know, when I was writing my book, I was thinking, how did this happen? You know, how did I watch a movie? And people watch lots of movies. And as people said to me before, you know, I watch a movie, but it doesn't mean I'm going to do all these things. But I think I got to a point where I was thinking, well, is this it? What have I got to lose? As a kid, I didn't want to lose. You know, I remember a quick story about a boy at school, 11 years of age, Richard Finch, he was called. And I thought he was a faster runner than me. And at sports day, he picked his events. And after he picked his events, I picked mine events. So he picked 100, I picked the 200 meters. He picked the 400, I picked the 800. He picked the long jump, I picked, you know, that sort of thing. I won all mine and he won all his. But I never knew whether I would actually be faster than him or not, because I wasn't prepared to look at myself in the mirror and not succeed. And I got to the point where actually that side of it didn't really matter as much. And I'm very much about succeeding. But I was prepared at this point. Something happened to me that actually I might not make it. Remember my brother saying to me in Japan, oh, I've looked up at this swim and if something goes wrong, it can be impossible to cross. And I said, well, that's not going to happen, so we don't need to worry about it. Anyway, what are you doing at the weekend? Because I didn't want any negativity. I didn't want to discuss you know, I had injuries and all the rest of it. I didn't want to discuss any negativity. I think going back to what you said about happiness and what it was about with me was, yeah, I think you've got a point. I didn't want to go back selling the appliances. But I did, the thing is, Tim, saying that, I didn't know a job was going to come out of it. So it was really about getting a...
No, yeah, I understand that, but it's not saying a job, but you don't want to be known for the guy who sells toasters. You wanted to be known for the guy who swam. I mean, like, your achievements are absolutely phenomenal. And I wonder if, you know, they always say desperation is the fuel for inspiration. And, yeah. You know, you were desperately looking at yourself, walking, going up and down to Manchester, selling toasters, going, I don't want to be known for this.
I mean, you know, it's funny because I don't see it. It's not necessarily somebody seeing me in a certain way. It was all about, because this is there's no fanfare, there's not really, you know, at the time a lot of exposure, or, you know, you don't do it, no one's going to say, yeah, who's that Adam Walker, who's that channel swimmer. It was more about discovering myself. And what I mean by that is, I think I'm only happy when I'm striving for something. So in the sales job, I used to get a real kick if I do a big sales deal, you know, and I remember doing one for Sainsbury's. I did the biggest deal that they've done, and I got this real boost that I felt that I'd achieved something. So it was about achievement. Felt like I achieved something, and I got that sort of great feeling about that I had purpose. What I'm not very good at, because I've done a number of jobs where they almost run themselves, the company, the big companies, and you just put things in place, you give them the products, you give them the promotions, et cetera, and they sell anyway. And that made me miserable, because what purpose do I have? So some people, it's like, well, that's a simple job. They're not going to get rid of those products. They're going to sell them. What an easy job. Pay pretty well for it. Get a company car. What's the problem? But for me, it's about Adam having some, this is what I've realized, having some sort of purpose on the planet, not for people to say how great he is, but just to feel like I've achieved something in my life. You know, have I been, I want to be a good person, I want to help people, I want to put these markers down that actually when I go to my grave, I've had some sort of purpose on the planet, as opposed to drifting on by and you know, okay, he had a decent enough job and he did all right. But I went through this sort of stage in my life where something's got to change, you know, something's not right. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I have to do something. And then I think I'll swim the channel. My brain goes, Ras, I've got to do that. I've got to do it because I need some sort of challenge in my life. Don't know where it'll take me. One swim then turned into another, because I was never doing Ocean 7 at the start. It was about one swim. And then it became, I feel like Adam. I feel like the person I'm supposed to be. And I mean, my boss said to me, what's the point? You don't get a gold medal. You don't get any money for this. In fact, it costs you money. Where's the incentive? And I said to him, because you're asking me that, there is no point me really answering, because you'll never understand. Because he said, you go to Dover and freeze in Dover and swim hours on end. And I'm with my kids and you know, relaxing. And look at you. You're suffering. Why would you want to do that?
Yeah, talking about that, by the way, I definitely had a very similar sort of situation to you. I was working in finance, trying to sell mortgages and stuff. And actually, I went to see my financial advisor yesterday, and I went to him, do you enjoy this? He goes, I absolutely love it. And I was like, I did it and I couldn't stand it. I mean, it's a great job if you get, you know, the perks and the money when you, I mean, I was useless at it, because I just couldn't get my head around this idea at all of doing it. And so I was like, I can't do this. And say desperation is the fuel for inspiration. And I was like, all right, I've got to go and find something to do. I didn't have any qualifications, any education, ended up working in TV. The one major thing that happened in my life, which is a real changer, and it's happened to you recently, is having my children. And your boss says he's spending time with his children. You've had a baby not so long ago. Has that changed anything for you? Because I remember the day I looked at my twins, I was like, oh, I get why I'm here now, to look after them, because that's my job now, to make sure they've got food in their mouths. Has that happened to you? Have you changed the way you perceive the world since having a baby?
Great question. Completely. Yeah. I mean, I have a 7-month-old baby, and, you know, it's really weird what's going on in my head now, because I'm so used to going for, you know, moving forward with the business that I've now got and driven. I took the swimming into then, you know, what I do now, and to move that forward, I'm constantly thinking of the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And then as I do that now, I'm then thinking of the baby. I want to spend more time with the baby. That's more important. So I've got this real confusing thing in my head now, which is, and I said to my partner, Gemma, you know, if you give me choice, I'll just stay with him and sort him out and spend every waking moment with him. I'm pretty happy with that. And it's a really, and I genuinely mean that. I think over time I would feel, as I was doing that more, there would probably be the old Adam saying, come on, we've got to do something. Because I think I can get it in my head now, the fact that when I'm doing it, I was doing it for Gemma, my partner, for myself, moving us forward. But I always had a bit of a master plan of having, hopefully having a baby. And then, you know, you can... you have a bit of a legacy to take on and, you know, and support him. So in my mind, the more I succeed, I suppose, in my working environment, then that also supports him. But I definitely want to spend more time with him. And part of what I've done here, which is I've built my own facility, gets me time back. Because before we had the baby, I went to 14 countries coaching. And now I can get time back. So, yeah, it's a great question. And it definitely has. And wholeheartedly, I love spending time. And if I don't have a coaching session sometimes, I think, oh, that's good. I can spend more time with him. And
well, we've done it this morning. We arranged the podcast at one stage and you then texted me and said, can we move it? Because I can spend more time with my baby. And it's like, yeah, of course you can, you know, because that's become important to you. And I wonder, we'll talk about your facility in a minute, by the way, because I think it's great and we need to talk about that. But I wonder if you were 28 when you started doing ocean swimming, if you were 25 when you'd had your baby, and then you wouldn't have been able to find the time to do it. So you would, I imagine, have, you'd be selling toasters and kettles still, because you'd need the finances, you'd need everything. So it's all about how it all slots in your life, wouldn't it? I wonder if you'd have managed to have that drive if you'd had the children or had a child earlier on in your life.
I think it's a really fair point. You know, you've got more things attached to you, more responsibilities, you know, in that sales path of doing the English Channel and then doing other swims. Now, what we haven't discussed is then I moved jobs, and also with those different sales jobs, I got made redundant a whole bunch of times. You know, I found myself in the wilderness with the job, but the only thing that was consistent was the swimming. Although that wasn't a job,
yeah,
it felt like that was the job. So things were sort of crumbling around me at that point. But I look back and think, you know, if I'd had a baby, things were crumbling around me. Would I have then taken the step to change? You know, I don't know.
Do you know what, Adam? I love doing this podcast. It makes me think. And I remember years ago, I just had my twins. I was 35 years old. And I remember talking to someone, I won't mention who's, but a kind of big famous star in TV who did massively well for himself. And I've given the sex away, there you go. But he said to me, oh, no, you fucked it. And I was like, what? He goes, oh, your dad, no, you can't do it. You're not going to make the great heights because you need to be a single man to do it. And he didn't mean like not in a relationship. He meant not being a parent. And he said, when you become a parent, it all changes. I watched it so many times of people around me and stuff like that. He was older than me. And he said, it's just your commitments change. And to make it, you know, for me to become the Saturday night, you know, my own show, maybe move to America, do all those dreams that you have when you're a kid and you're ambitious and you get into media. He's like, you can't do it as a dad because it all changes. You've got to put some effort into your children if you want to be a good dad. And I suppose then you look around the industry and you can see there are some absent fathers there because it is such a hard, you know, you can't swim seven oceans and be full-time dad because there's so much commitment to training. And I suppose that goes with a lot of industries out there. You want to be the head, you know, the top guy in the city or the top woman in the city. Something's got to give because there's only so many hours in a day and you need that.
We're having lots of these sort of conversations at the moment with me still traveling abroad and doing the coaching. And it's like it's all coming from me that I'm thinking, well, actually, you know, I'm I used to do sort of 2 week camp in Malta, a 2 week camp in Turkey. You know, I do all these different places, and now I've gone to 1 week, and you know, and it's all my decision of how much I do. And if I decided to do longer, then you know, my partner, I'm sure would be fine with that. But then maybe that would put more pressure. I'm sure it would on her to look after them for, you know, those 2 weeks and then another 2 weeks. I mean, you know, I'm saying all this, and this, what we're in May now, I'm going to Turkey at the weekend. I'm doing a week in Turkey, and then I come back a week and I go for a week in Italy. And then in June I go to Tenerife for 3 days, but normally I would do longer. So I'm sort of juggling around, but those bits in between, it's getting time in order to get that balance. It's all about balance, isn't it?
It is, but also I'm not a marriage guidance counselor, so I don't know about relationships, and mine haven't been the best in the world. But as a parent, I do believe that you're supposed to be setting an example for your children. And one of the examples is you're supposed to enjoy your work, because we've all had parents who hate their work. And that is a miserable thing as a child to think, when I grow up, I'm going to be miserable because there's my parents. If you can find a job you love, like you have, never apologize for it, because your children, I think, will grow up and go, I want to be like my dad, who did something really exciting. And like, he was traveling the world, teaching people how to swim. What an amazing career and job he had. And you know, as long as the time, I always think, as long as you're showing attention, full attention to children when you're with them, that is one of the That's one of the gifts you can give them is, and I've been poor at that sometimes in my life, and you know, I think we all have, but I think that's the key, and I also think, as I say, the key is to really enjoy yourself. So when they grow up, they think, can't wait to be an adult so I can enjoy my life even more than I'm enjoying it now.
Yeah. You can learn a lot from kids, can't you? You know, you see,
100%.
I've never seen a human being in the last, I don't know, so many years smile. One human being smile as much as my baby. And I get inspiration from my 7-month-old, thinking, you know, I'm always trying to be sort of upbeat and driven and happy, and you know, and we're always sort of working at that in some way for this happiness. Whereas naturally, the smallest things makes him happy, like making some noises or smiling at him. And, you know, and I said to Gemma, I get such inspiration. People should look at him. And because isn't it funny, when a baby smiles, an adult then smiles, and it reminds them, actually, we need to smile more and we need to be more happy. Mm. So, yeah, absolutely. And I said to her, I really hope as he gets older, you know, and obviously things are going to change, but I really want to harness this happiness that he's got now. And I don't want the world to pollute that. I don't want him to worry, you know, social media and all those things that I'm sure I could have a separate podcast about. But I'm just really sensitive about just keeping him going in the right direction, upbeat, positive, and happy.
Adam, I want to get on in a minute to, you invented a new way of swimming and you've got a new facility, which I want to talk about. So just really quick answer on these two things. So I'm really intrigued by them. I want to very quickly talk about cold and how you overcome it, and nutrition, how you get enough calories on board yourself as you're swimming for 17 hours. So let's start with nutrition. How do you get calories on board whilst you're swimming 17 hours in an ocean?
So I think I mentioned it earlier about the bottle that's thrown over the side with a rope attached to it. So you get a carb drink. That's around about 300 calories. I decide to have it every half hour after a couple of hours to get fuel on board. So in an hour, you get 600 calories, but you lose up to 1,000. So you need to get, and that's a full, that's like a 300, 400 mil drink. But if you're sick, obviously you're burning more. So really, you're always in some sort of deficit. The night before, you can have carbs, pasta, and you've got the first hour and a half, which actually you've got the reserve, you've got the reserve calories. But in the end, you are going to burn your body, and we have lots of fat stores, and the body will convert and start burning that, because you can't take enough. I personally can't take enough fuel. I mean, I'm a bad example. I was sick on pretty much every one of my swims, so God knows what it was burning. I mean, I'd used to come out and I'd look really lean and, you know, lost a lot of muscle, and then it would rebuild. So the idea of doing that all day, you will be in deficit, but you just got to keep that energy on board.
Do you, Do you try and put on weight before you go for a swim? Do you try and
can help.
Some fat on?
Yeah, can help. I mean, in terms of temperature that you were asking about, in terms of getting used to the COLD word, the word I haven't said for years, then acclimatization is number one. So the more dips you do, the more you get used to it. Number two, to complement that, is the mindset, a positive mind, not saying those sort of words or anything associated to them and disconnecting them was what I learned as very powerful. And number three, putting a bit of weight can help, but I've never been large, let's say, even when I did Ireland to Scotland, which I was 102 kilos, but I'm 6 foot five and a half. So just over 16 stones. I'd never class myself as fat.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about cold. And your author's notes, your book. By the way, his book's called Man Versus Ocean. It's really good. It's a great read. For the purposes of this book, I have often referred to cold water. Please note that this word does not exist in my mind as it is negative and serves no purpose, no positive purpose in the sport of open water swimming. Obviously, you need the word cold if you're trying to sell fridges and freezers and stuff. but if you're swimming the oceans, So how do you stay warm when you're swimming in these freezing cold oceans? I imagine some of them are warmer than others, but, you know, how does it work?
Yeah, I mean, the coolest, I'll say coolest, was Ireland to Scotland, which was 13.5 degrees. So that was a good 3 degrees cooler than the English Channel. The reason that the toughest seven ocean swims in the world is worth you knowing is deadly marine life, extreme COLD, tides, current strongest in the world. So they've all got various different reasons. Like in Japan, over 2,000 people have drowned because boats capsized, and they actually created a tunnel system underground so people don't have to go on ferries, so let alone swim it. Cook Strait, New Zealand, lots again have capsized and drowned as a result of how rough it can get. And then you've got temperature and extreme. So you've got all these sort of different reasons. But going back to what you said about, were you asking about how to get used to it?
Cold. Yeah, sorry, the cool temperatures.
Yeah. So getting used to temperature. The more dips that you do, the more you get used to it mentally. And I believe the brain talks to the body, and you're never comfortable. You're always uncomfortable. But once you get comfortable being uncomfortable, then that's one thing. But the worst thing that you can do is go in and go, oh, I'm going to freeze. Oh, it's going to be terrible. Oh, it's going to be awful. And guess what? You get what you focus on. So that's how you feel. I went in yesterday in my lake, and it's 16 degrees, and people are wrapped up in gloves, and they're bigger than me. They've got more weight, but they haven't got necessarily the experience and therefore the mindset. So the brain talks to the body, number one. And all I did to combat it, a lot of the time I would talk to myself, I'd imagine swimming in a warm ring. I would swim to warm, hot, warm, hot, warm, hot, warm, different versions of it. Because while you're thinking positive, you can't think negative. While you're thinking you're warm, you can't think you're not warm. While you think you're going to achieve the swim, you can't think you're not going to achieve the swim. You can't think two things at once. So you flood your mind full of positive thoughts, whatever that might be, in this case, warmth, and lots of dips. A bit of weight can help. But, you know, I've suffered for hours, and it's funny how, you know, when I first started this in 2007, 2008, I was the same weight as I did the English Channel, and yet I swam in 9 degrees, 40 minutes, 5 paramedics in a real mess, and then fast forward years later, 9 degrees, I can do 3 hours and I'm fine. Why? Because it's not a weight thing. It's not even the fact I've done lots of swims in between, because I'm working more now, so I'm not swimming as much. So it has to be something to do with the brain talking to the body. Let's not panic. And the visualization. Doctors will say that's rubbish. It's physiology will kick in the end. And eventually it will. But I think you can combat a lot from the brain. And I've gone through that many six-hour swims where I've been shivering and because, you know, something like your teeth shattering, you know, when people go, la, 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 oh, it's so cold. Oh, yeah, it's so, oh, look at my teeth. Oh, look, I'm shaking. Oh, look at my hands. And they're actually talking themselves through shivering and being miserable. I've shattered my teeth once, and I've done ice swims, 4 ice swims, like a mile under 5 degrees, 3 degrees, I think was my coolest, in trunks. And never since that one day in 2008 have I shattered my teeth ever. I've managed to calm myself down, talk to my body in a sense. Let's calm. Let's get the breathing. Rather than, oh, look, Tim, I'm freezing. Oh, it's like an acknowledgement. I want you to know that I'm freezing. I'm suffering, mate. I'm really bad. I'm going to get worse, aren't I? Go on, tell me how bad. Oh, yeah, you look freezing, mate. Oh, you're suffering. Yeah, I am. Yeah, I am. And we suffer together. You know, it's whereas actually you can change the mindset cycle and go, it's going to be warm today, isn't it? Oh, yeah, it's going to be warm. Are you going to enjoy it? Yeah, I'm going to love it. And by being in that positive mindset can combat temperature. I tried it with you to convince you when you came here, didn't I? But maybe we need a few more sessions.
All right, let's talk about let's talk about how you developed a new type of swimming then. So one of the things I do believe in is there's no such thing as winning and losing. It's just life. You're just playing it out, because sometimes you win and lose. Like, you know, I always use this example of Johnny Wilkinson, who won the World Cup, woke up the next day miserable as hell. Ewan Thomas, I interviewed recently, won the Worlds, woke up the next day and felt really down, because you lose, because you've lost, you've won, but you've lost the point of life, because the point was to win. And so there's always winning and losing. And you've just said there, your swim to Hawaii, you know, you were trying to beat the fastest time. You ended up losing that, but winning something else by being in the water for the longest you've ever been, and proving you could do that. And, you know, the extremes you went through. So you won in that sense. Now, you got injured whilst doing these swims. And rather than give up like everybody else would do and say, and the doctors told you to give up, I believe, you decided, no, I'm going to find another way to swim. And through that, you've invented a better way of swimming than you used to do it. Tell us about that.
Sometimes from misfortune, positive things can happen. So what I mean by that is, leading up to the English Channel and getting inspired, I took a saving water polo, played water polo at the time in goal, and it made a cracking noise. And gradually through the training, I'm used to injuries, knee problems, back problems. So I swam through it, but it got worse and worse the longer I swam. And I started seeing physio twice a week, and they advised me to see a hypnotherapist, and they taught me how to disconnect pain or not to focus on pain. And I use that in lots of other areas, like focus on warm and, you know, focusing on the mm-hmm. achieving the goal. Now, as it got worse and I managed to disconnect the pain, fortunately, I got through the English Channel and I looked up at the sky and I said, or the ocean actually in this case, please, ocean gods, let me get across this swim and I'll never do this awful sport again. You know, just give me this moment with my dodgy shoulder and that'll be it. And then as I was traveling back from the English Channel, I thought, well, I may be pretty good at this. You know, maybe I can continue and I'll just find out what's going on with the shoulder. So anyway, 18 months of literally trying to rehabilitate in the gym, and I had a scan. The scan didn't show a problem. And 18 months later, they said, well, we better actually have surgery. And it turns out I did have a ruptured bicep tendon. And what the surgeon said to me is, you had a ruptured bicep tendon prior to the English Channel because it's actually tried to heal itself. It's attached to another tendon. And he said, do you ever want to swim again? And I said, well yeah, I want to swim from Spain to Morocco. I've decided I want to do one more. He said, no, you'll not do that. Your shoulder's far too bad for that. I meant for leisure. And we had this joke saying, well, Spain to Morocco is leisure for me. And he said, look, if you want to go, we'll have to have a second operation, but it's a real mess. And I've got this report that says partial success, and alluded to the fact that I'd only ever be sort of 70% fit. So I thought, well, I better actually find a way to keep going with this sport. And rather than what I've done in the past, which is just brute power and no finesse and typical bloke thinking I can muscle my way through it, actually let's look at how I swim. So what I did was I started looking at rotation, which I didn't invent, but I thought this will take pressure off the shoulder. And then as I drove my arm in to rotate, that hurt me. So I thought, I've got to find a way of getting my arm in the water. And basically, I created a method that took pressure off the shoulder in a number of different ways, but also showed me how I could be more efficient as a result. And ironically, I thought I was going to be slow as a result of this, but accept it to get through a few more swims. But I then got faster and faster, because the bits that I learned, and I put physics to it, I looked at other sports like golf as hips and boxing and climbing and all the rest of it. But I found a method to take pressure off the shoulder and to actually go faster for longer. So then, rather than go Spain to Morocco, I thought, I wonder if I can go both ways, because it's half the distance of the English Channel. let's try and go both ways. No British person had gone both ways. And there was a reason for that, because it's super, you have to be super fast on the way back. But I got through that. And then that's when my mind opened to Ocean 7, because this new stroke, I thought, well, maybe it'll get me across another. And I did another, and maybe it'll get across another. And, you know, managed to do all 7 out of 7 without any failed attempts. And when I was doing the last swim, I then was thinking about, well, a few people getting interested in how I swam. And I went to this trip in Tunisia, and there was 10 top swimmers in the world, open water swimmers. And one of them was assistant coach of the Malta Olympic team. And he said, I've never seen someone swim so effortless. Can you show me how to do it? And it was, I had a free accommodation, and I went with my partner, and I just met her. And I said to her, look, we've got this luxury hotel, and I promise you that. And every morning, 6 a.m, I was up coaching these guys. So that's why I got the idea of maybe doing one small group. And then a year later, I did 7 groups. Then I did 27 in a year. And then now I go around the world doing it. And as a result of this misfortune, really, people want to, they've got a lot of injuries. Every single camp that I do, there's at least half of them with some sort of shoulder injury. So it turned into a business, gave up the sales job, and did the coaching. And then as an extension of that, then decided to build my own facility, thinking I can reach more people. And that's then when I built a facility from a disused goat farm, which I've got an endless pool and a lake now. So, but again, the swimming has taught me the confidence to go for these sort of things. Without the swimming, would the old Adam 15 years ago be confident enough to build his own facility from a, you know, messy goat farm and go through 4 years of what I've been through? Absolutely not. But that was the reward that the swimming gave me.
Yeah, and if you want to see him swim, if you go to a good place to go is Instagram, Adam Ocean Walker, and it's so effortless, and you swim effortlessly, and it's just, it's rapid, it's quick, it looks beautiful. I've taken some a lesson off you, haven't I? Because I wanted to learn how to do it, and it is, it's kind of trying to sort of. It's hard to explain this really, but it's like trying to swim sideways, isn't it? Trying to get your body sideways at 90 degrees to get as least friction as you can through the water. I'm trying to master it. It's you know, obviously it's a real mindset to change the way we swim, because we're all taught to swim pretty much flat and maybe rotate around sort of 20, 30 degrees, and we're going all the way up into 90 degrees. So it's a very different way of swimming.
Yeah, I mean, you know, think about a fish. Fish is great, streamlined. You'd think for a reason it swims on its side. When we push off the wall in Olympic event, they push off on their side because they know it's more efficient. When people are snorkeling, they snorkel on their side because they know it's more efficient. So why do we then swim flat? So, you know, rotation, as I say, has been around a while, but the level of rotation has been smaller. The reason it's been smaller, in my opinion, is it's the importance of keeping the head still. So it's harder to keep your head still, particularly if you're going through the chest. What I now have learned is to swim feet upwards. And by going feet upwards rather than chest downwards, I manage to isolate the hips. The hip goes first, and then it sends the arm into the water, and it creates more power. Think of golf, think of racket sports, climbing, stand-up paddleboarding. You only need to look at stand-up paddleboarding and kayaking. It says put the paddle in, bring the core back, the hips, and then the paddle, i.e. the chest with the paddle, follows the hips. Now, if that movement is similar to swimming, you take the boat away, then that is the principle. So I'm only taking that principle. People go, oh God, you know, feet upwards. But all I'm doing is the principle of what we do on land, using the hips.
The only problem with it, Adam, as I've said to you, is I do 1,000 meters, and I do it, you know, three times a week probably. And, you know, I go in, I like to bang it out. I like to finish my 1,000 meters. I'm absolutely bloody exhausted. And with your technique, I'm not as exhausted as I was. So I don't feel like I'm getting to try. It's so much more relaxed, and I'm not muscling my way through the water. As you say, you feel like I feel with the way that Adam does it, the stroke, it's more of a, you feel like you're gliding more rather than pulling more, you're gliding more, which is psychologically feels so much nicer to be doing. But also, you've got me breathing only one time. And as I've said to you, I sent the video to a few of my friends of me swimming in your endless pool, and they're going, why aren't you doing bilateral breathing? And I'm like, because Adam told me to get some oxygen in. Yeah. And it's a really strange feeling getting oxygen as you go through it, rather.
Yeah. Adam tells you to do what you do on land, which is breathe regularly. When I say to people, you know, with Mo Farah, does a running coach say to Mo Farah, hold your breath for 30 seconds and we'll make you fitter? You go, no, you just breathe regular. So why do you put water in the way and then say, I tell you what, hold your breath for a while so then we can starve you of oxygen, make you physically tight, and then you can explode the CO2 out and then get it back in and make yourself more tired. It absolutely doesn't make sense at all. So the one thing people have said that before, saying, oh, the problem is I'm used to feeling like tense, that I've burnt my body. And I was the same. You know, I used to swim before this, and I wasn't happy unless every muscle in my body was screaming at me, and I thought that's the way to go. And then when I thought that's a bit daft really though, because surely when I want to swim longer, don't I want to use the minimum amount of energy and muscles, because muscles require oxygen, possible in order to then maintain that speed and also not put pressure on my shoulder and my body, because that's the key here. Because there's lots of things we could talk about, but just a quick one. When you swim on your side, you've got natural elevation of your shoulder. And what that means is you don't have to lift overhead. The biggest causes of injury in swimming by swimming flat is lifting overhead. A high catch is number two, and spearing is number three. Well, we don't do any of those. We sweep around the side, which has been proven worked with the body's natural range. I drop it so it doesn't spear, it drops via the hip rotation into a low position. And by being in a low position, it's easier to get the pull, no pressure on the shoulder. And, you know, everything works with the jigsaw, but it's understanding each piece in order to do. And the byproduct of that is exactly when you said that with a laughing face to me and you said, you know, I've got too much oxygen now. I thought, yeah, the amount of times that I've been told that and it's no miracle. I'm not this, you know, incredible scientist that says if you breathe regularly, you use less energy, guess what? You're going to be able to swim further and you're going to be fitter as a result. And people go, it's a revelation. I always say, you know, I have to be careful what I say, but, you know, if we were all taught to hop and the whole world was hopping and then that's how we get around, and then some dude comes along and says, why don't we put the other leg down? And that's called walking. Go, oh, that looks good. But I'll stick with hopping because the whole world's hopping. And then they fail. you know where I'm going with this. The things change. Look, you know, that's the thing. Things develop.
There's this beautiful footage of Olympic Games years ago. I think it was the one Hitler did, and I don't remember what year that was in Germany. But they're doing the breaststroke, maybe 100 meters or something. And some of them are swimming with their heads up. Some of them are swimming with their heads going into the water. They won, by the way. And then one of the guys is swimming butterfly, because obviously, clearly, at that stage, there was not a separate stroke. And so it's like, it was so strange watching all these different strokes, but the majority of the field were swimming with their head up out of the water. Yeah. So clearly, at one stage, they decided, hold on, we need to be sticking the head in the water because you get quicker. The guy won, by the way, stuck the head. It's great footage if you look it up. Things evolve. Adam, we're coming to the end of our hour, and I like to keep it kind of tight. So we've actually gone over an hour. But just very quickly, can you quickly tell us the shark story, because it is such a beautiful story. Would you mind?
Yeah, so in the Cook Strait in New Zealand, I was sick after about 3 hours and lots of different challenges that I had. You know, we haven't talked about Japan with the big swells in Sagaru Chan, Japan.
Is that what you showed me the picture of?
Yeah, the video of you know, 10 to 12 foot swells and 50 and a half hours.
That was unbelievable. You can't swim those. You have to surf them. It was unbelievable how big.
It was like swimming in a hot tub, but it wasn't quite as warm as that. But I got through that 15 and a half hours and in the Catalina Channel, swam with one arm for 7 hours when my shoulder packed in for the third time. So again, you'll have to read Man versus Ocean.
Good book.
That you'll get signed by Adam Walker if you go on his website. There's a little bit of a plug. But then we got to the Cook Strait and I looked up and I thought, oh God, when I was being sick, please give me something positive. You know, ocean gods. And then all of a sudden, a fin came flying towards me. It's not like Jaws. It's not slow-mo. They're just there. And then I had 12 dolphins basically barricading me in. I thought, this is absolutely incredible. After 20 minutes, I looked down and I saw a much deeper dolphin moving differently, that, as I joke, I had pointed teeth and a different fin, but I didn't see the pointed teeth. So that was sort of tracking me. I got a drink and the dolphins stop, and then I continue. If you want to look at Adam Walker swimming with dolphins on YouTube, you'll see the video. and it barricaded me in. And this happened for an hour and a half. And people say, oh, weren't you scared of the shark? But I had a choice. Do I focus on the dolphins or do I focus on the shark? You know, the warm. Do you focus on warm or do you focus on not warm?
Yeah, I love it.
So I focus on, I chose the dolphins and basically gave amazing. One would circle me for an hour. And what I've read up on since, and I did a documentary where I interviewed scientists on dolphin intelligence, they circle their young to protect them. So one would come, was literally about 2 or 3 inches in front of my hands, no matter how fast I went. And I had one on the side eyeballed me for 10 minutes, and it made me pretty emotional. It was just an incredible spiritual thing, and I wouldn't class myself as a spiritual person. And the amazing thing is all 6 channel swims I did for whale and dolphin conservation. So I was trying to get out there to protect whales and dolphins. And then I have this experience with the dolphins where they're so connected to me. And bear in mind, you know, dolphins are like kids. They'll get bored. You know, I'm very, very slow compared to a dolphin. The dolphin's 30 mile an hour and I'm 4.5K an hour. So it must have been boring. And there's nothing more demotivated than a dolphin hardly looking like it's moving and you're going as fast as you can. But it was absolutely incredible and something that I felt like almost like a reward for what I'd been through. And then, you know, forgot about the shark, carried on, and it drove me forward to finish the swim. So, you know, and there's an amazing picture if you look online with a dolphin in midair, and all the media around the world said, have you superimposed that? It looks too good, but it is a real picture. So, yeah, incredible.
Yeah, that's it is amazing. An amazing story. Right, Adam, a couple more questions, just quick ones here. What is one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life that you'd like to give our listeners?
My dad saying never give up. You know, we've heard it all before, but not to give up on the dreams that you have. You know, I always wanted to be a sports person, a professional sports person at the age of 27, 20, 28, being injured and written off. You know, I thought maybe that would have been it, but I never gave up hope on the dream, and it came to fruition. So you just got to keep going. And if something you want bad enough, don't give up on it.
I love the bit at the beginning of your book. I'd like to dedicate this book to anyone who has ever had a dream and may feel it unreachable or has been told it's unachievable. Believe, inspire, succeed. Final question, Adam, what's the meaning of life?
What a great final question. Happiness. To be happy, do whatever you do to be happy. Also, I think the meaning in life is to be good to others. You know, we're all here on the planet for one time. Be good to others, help others, be good to yourself. Try and be happy, whatever that happiness brings. And it doesn't have to be swimming. It doesn't have to be ocean swimming. It can be anything you want. But you know, that to me is the meaning of life. Just to be happy and find happiness for others.
Perfect. Where should people go? What's your website address?
So if you look at oceanwalkeracademy.com, then you'll find the lake. We have a 750-meter lake called Crystal Lake, and I also have coaching that I do in the Endless Pool, so check that out. But if you put also oceanwalkeracademy.com as well, actually for one-to-one lessons, oceanwalkeruk.com for one-to-one lessons, oceanwalkeracademy.com if you want to swim in the lake, and you'll find my book on there as well. But yeah, just you know, follow your dreams, everybody, and don't give up at all, and don't think that I'm anything special, because I'm not. I'm just a dude who watched a movie on an aeroplane who decided to swim a bunch of ocean swims. And I'm very lucky and appreciative that it changed my life. And that could be you.
Perfect. Thanks, Adam.